Again, I don't know if anyone here is new. I'll just say that this is a continuation, in case there are new people, this is a continuation of what we've been doing now for, I don't know, about a year and a half. I think there's some 40 classes online. And we'll continue going on. Now, because it's a continuation of what we've been doing, by the way, and for those who are new, you can, if you don't want to see the boxes, if you can stack them, you can enlarge my face, you can do whatever you want. You can send questions. Oh, you're new, Bella. Okay, well, you can send questions at the bottom, or you can speak. At the end, we spend time with comments and questions. So let us begin. Although before we begin, I just want to, I guess you could say housekeeping, or because this is a continuation, and many people were in contact with me between this semester and last semester, there's a couple of comments I want to make with regard to things last semester. And also because many people are listening to these online, and therefore if I make an error or something isn't clear, I can still correct it, so that's good. And finally, let me point out also, although these classes are free, and that's really great, Torrent Motion is the leader in this technology. Those who enjoy it are certainly encouraged to give some donation, any donation they want. And all 35 past classes can be downloaded. I just want to make a couple points before we start, because there is a lot to do. We're going to begin with Rav Shach, a very important figure. I think, though, I need to make a comment, at least briefly, about what's going on in Israel with the conversion business there, those who have been following the news, not for political reasons, only because it relates very much to what we did last semester. Those who will recall, we spoke about Rav Uziel's position, Rav Gorin's position, Rav Unterman's position, and we spoke about at great length this very issue, can you void conversions, this sort of thing. From the political standpoint, I have an article in this week's Jewish Week that's out sometime on Wednesday, but just from the halachic, I think it's interesting, if you explore, you'll find Rav Druckman's response, and he's agreed by, Rav Dachovsky agrees with him, and he's used to be a dayan on this very court, that there's no such thing as the halacha police, that you go through the training, 10 months, people make a commitment to halacha, and then that's it, then you're Jewish. And so it really is going to be interesting to see how all this plays out. In my article in the Jewish Week, I say the issue really isn't conversion, it's about dayanim. And the Haredim refuse to accept a modern Orthodox or religious Zionist as having any reliability whatsoever. If that wasn't the case, I don't see how you can void thousands of conversions without ever speaking to the people. It's a, you must assume ahead of time that these Dayanim are not valid, although I will show you, since we're on the topic briefly, here is a picture. Are we one people? Well, in my piece in the Jewish Week, my point is that really we're not really one people. And the Haredim have already decided that they don't want to be one people with us, so maybe the modern Orthodox should simply say, we don't need to be either. In other words, obviously, halachically we're one people, but we can have our own post-game, our own halachic authorities. We don't need to constantly give in for there to be this so-called one standard, which always is going to be the Haredi standard, because they never see the need to give in to the other way, so... sometimes, what's the expression, good fences make good neighbors. That might, everyone might be better off if the religious Zionists have their own Beis Din. But here's a picture, for those who are interested, at the bottom, of Rav Druckman with Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. I mean, Rav Druckman's a Rosh Yeshiva, a Hezri Yeshiva, or a Tzion, widely revered and highly regarded. So this is going to play out in the next few days. Are we expected one Messiah? Well, that no, either, because if Messiah comes and he's wearing a kippah serugah, well, certain people won't accept him. If he's wearing a black hat, other people won't accept him. So I guess everyone needs their own Mashiach. Okay, a few more comments briefly again with regard to last semester. Just quickly, because people have emailed me, we ended with Rav Kafach, and really there we needed more time for Rav Kafach. But I just want to clarify a couple things. I mentioned the Sidur. One of you contacted me about the Sidur that the Dardayim use, Siach Yerushalayim, and I can send you the link. It's on. You can buy it online. It's not a pure Dardai Sidur. It's a Baladi's version, but the Dardayim use it, but they don't say everything in it. I also mentioned last semester, and I want to clarify this, that there were some places where they only studied the Rambam. That's actually not true. There were places they only studied the Rif. And there are places where they only paskened, according to the Rambam, but I haven't been able to find any places where they didn't study Talmud. They only studied the Rambam, which incidentally is what the Rambam says in the introduction to the Mishnah Torah, that all you have to do is study the written law and then study this book. We had places, as I said, where they only studied Rif. They didn't study Talmud, but not the Rambam. And finally, let me just say, because a couple of people emailed me, I just want to clarify briefly again for 2 minutes more about Rav Kafa, what's made him significant. You don't have people like this anymore. Try to imagine a Beit Midrash where everyone is trained to copy manuscripts, to be sofrim, to make tefillin cases, to make the ink, to make the parchment, to be shochti, to do nikur, to do meal, all this. I mean, today, go into yeshiva and find someone who knows how to make tzitzis. Even to wrap them, it's impossible to find. So it's a very different. The people who knew to identify all the plants mentioned in the Gemaras, all the animals, it's a very different type of thing. Now, one of you asked me a question about what the Yemenites do on the yurt site. And Rav Kafach was actually asked this question, incidentally. And he replied that the Yemenites do what the Rambam says. So he was asked, well, the Rambam says you don't do anything on yurt site. And he replied, that's exactly what the Yemenites do. So then, and this is quoted, by the way, in the Sefer Zikaro, in the Memorial Volume for him. So then the question was, this questioner asked him, well, does that mean that when you're dead, you're completely dead? And Rav Kafach says, yes, you are completely dead. And that relates to what we said last semester, that we're not interested in appealing to the saints or being concerned. Our job is to follow Torah and mitzvos, and we're in this world. What happens in the next world happens in the next world. Finally, and I thought this was really interesting, I only read this last week. One of my kids has this book, you probably have it, or maybe your kids have it, about how Rashi became a great sage. There's a legend how his father did some great mitzvah, and he found inside a fish a diamond or something and returned it, and because of that Rashi was zocha to be a great sage. Rav Kafach goes off on this. He says, these sorts of legends are invented by Ami Haaretz, by ignoramuses. They want you to think that becoming a great sage is some gift from God, when in actuality it's as we'll see with Rav Shach, it's sitting and learning and working on yourself. There's no one coming down and giving it to you. And it's really interesting the way he describes how people who are Amei Aretz, they want to give some justification to why they're not great Talmudic scholars. So he claims they invent these stories that you need this help from God or else you can't achieve it. And finally, one more thing. I had the pleasure recently of spending a whole afternoon with the chairman of the board of Yeshiva University, Maury Weiss, who's the son-in-law of Stone, the late Stone from the Stone Chumash of American Greeting Cards, and I finally asked him, is it true what I repeated? I didn't say it's true, I said, this is the story, that the Stone family approached YU first to do a Chumash, and he said, it's absolutely false, but he did tell me very interesting things about the Art Scroll situation, which I don't think I can get into, maybe because they're in confidence, but it's an interesting story, and Dr. Lamb's role in it, I'll ask him next time I see him if I can repeat it. No such thing as higher special souls, no. We're all the same. For Rav Kafach, we're all the same soul. In fact, you're born, your soul pretty much is empty. You have a nefesh, which is a life force, but you don't really have the soul per se. The soul, the intellectual part has to be, you fill it with matter. When you're born, you only have the life force, and it's our job to fill it through our study and everything else. So, if you haven't heard, I don't know if you knew, David, you can listen to the last two classes on Rav Kafach. Okay, let's now, though, move to Rav Shach, Rav Elazar Menachem Man Shach. And I think it's really, again, I have to give a lot of, I think, credit to Torah in Motion. You know, this is a modern Orthodox organization. I said this right before we did the talks on the Satmar Rebbe. I'm sure many of you are going to be very upset by some of the things I report that was his ideology, but it's important to study everyone, all the great scholars. It doesn't mean that we have to agree with them, but I do think we need to respect them, and we need, certainly from a historical standpoint, to know what they believed in. And I think this is what's so important, that we're able to examine all sides, and although we don't necessarily agree with all sides, really have a good perspective on everyone. And it was Rav Shach who really brings about a turning point in Orthodoxy in the 1970s, 80s, into the 90s. He is the one who led the Lithuanian Torah world into the mainstream of Israeli politics. It was under his leadership that the Israeli society as a whole was for the first time introduced to the non-Hasidic Haredim. I mean, in 1970, the typical, not just the typical non-religious, the typical Haredi, the typical religious Zionist knew nothing about the Panavez Yeshiva. Probably never even heard of it, most of them. I mean, and by the 1980s, this is the center of a whole movement. This late 70s into the 80s was a time of tremendous growth and also conflict, as we'll see, in the Haredi world. It was a time of growing confidence in the movement, that is, the movement of the Lithuanian, the Litvish yeshiva world, of a feeling that the future is theirs, and also an enormous growth in population, and they are reaping, as we speak now, their takeover of the chief rabbinate of the Beis Din. They are really reaping the benefits of this growth from 20 years ago. It was also during this time that the notion of Das Torah really attained prominence, significance that it never before had. While some of the changes would have happened with or without Rav Shach, I don't think there's any question that his influence was crucial in so many ways. And had it been another leader, it would have been very different. You wouldn't have had the conflicts that we're going to speak about. There were other great Rosh Yeshiva, like Rabbi Cheskel Sarn and others from the Chevron Yeshiva, who had a much more liberal view when it came to Zionism, religious Zionism. You would have had a very different type of yeshiva movement. Everyone knows Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach had a much more open view. So Rav Shach really becomes very important, and in particular, something we'll speak about, his battle against Chabad, which we'll have to consider, and against, not just against Chabad, at least from the Hasidic perspective, what they viewed as his battle against Hasidus in general was not shared by all Rosh Yeshiva, yet it was he, Rav Shach, who emerged as the dominant figure. Now, he's been dead for 7 years. He died at the age of 100 and, well, he's born in... He died in 2001. According to all the biographies, he died at the age of 103, but there seems to be some confusion if he was actually born in 1898. And just to give you an example, here's a book that came out just this year, focused on him and all the terrible things he is supposedly responsible for. It's called Amita Shel Sheker Bein Manhig LeManhig Beirur Mishnah Tov Hashkafato Shel Rav Elazar Nachman Shach Milchamto b'chassidim b'chal, u'kvod kedushas maran ha'admor m'yugabavich, etc. It's a thick book, 7 years after his passing, a whole book describing all the problems, as we'll speak about, all the terrible things they think for Rav Shach is responsible for. I'll describe this in a few minutes and put it into context. Who published it? Well, it's this guy, it's a privately published book. You can't get this at any Sfarim store. His name is Shaulson. He had a newspaper and he had a feud. I mean, he's sort of Lubavitch. And he had a feud with Rav Shach for years and years. And we'll see why, in a few minutes. But let me begin with the biography. He was born in 1898 in a small Lithuanian town. At the age of seven, he sent to the nearby city of Panevėžys for more advanced studies. There was not yet a Panevėžys yeshiva. The Panevėžys yeshiva, which they say today is maybe the largest yeshiva in the world, it was a minor yeshiva, which only really began in around World War I, and it didn't exist when Rav Shach went to it. He was able to study, though, in Panevėžys. The issue was that in this small town, there weren't any melamdim who could train him. So he went to Panevėžys, he lived with a family, and this is how it was in Lithuanian cities. The learning went on in the local Batei Midrash, the local Beis Medrash. And that's where the Rav would give a shiur. They didn't have great yeshivas in most places. This really begins at the end of the 19th century when you have an explosion of yeshivas. At the age of 13, he was sent to the Sabotki Yeshiva, which I'm sure most of you know is a very important, if not the most important, of the yeshiva. We've already spoken about it with regard to the Sri Yesh, Rabbi Chaya of Weinberg, as well as others. And from Sabotka, he went to Slutsk to study in the great yeshiva of Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer, the Evan HaAzel. Now, this yeshiva later moves to Klitsk in Poland. This happens after Slutsk is taken over after the revolution by the communists. Rav Aaron Cutler, Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer's son-in-law, becomes the exclusive Rosh Yeshiva in 1925 when Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer goes to Eretz Yisrael. The Lakewood Yeshiva that we have today in Lakewood is the continuation of the Slutsk-Kletsk Yeshiva. It was the Kletsk Yeshiva at World War II, and then Rav Aaron Cutler makes his way to the United States, and he reopens this yeshiva as the continuation. They didn't call it Kletsk, though. They called it Beis Midrash Gavoa, Lakewood Yeshiva, but this is Kletsk Slutsk, the same tradition. Now, Rav Shach becomes very close to Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer, and Rav Isser Zalman even makes a shidduch for him with his niece. But ideologically, he would be much closer to Rav Aaron Cutler. Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer was much more moderate than Rav Aaron Cutler. Rav Aaron Cutler was really an extremist. He's one of the people who actually did not support the creation of the State of Israel. He argued against it at the 1937 Aguda meeting. I think it was in Marienbad. There were a few members of Aguda who were opposed to it. Rav Aaron Cutler and Rav Chanan Wasserman, not Rav Isser Zalman. In fact, when Rav Isser Zalman goes to Israel, he becomes very close with and a great admirer of Rav Kook. I have a little pamphlet here, a whole pamphlet devoted to the relationship of Rav Kook and Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer. An article came out a couple years ago, by Yoel Finkelman. Some of you might know the name. I believe he's on the competition, the Web Yeshiva, giving a class. He wrote about the Slutsk-Kletsk Yeshiva in Europe, and he records testimony there from someone who's still alive, one of the last graduates. This person was actually thrown out of the Kletsk Yeshiva because he had engaged in Zionist activities. This is when Rav Isser Zalman was still living in Kletsk, but he wasn't yet, hadn't gone to Israel. He wasn't really actively involved in the yeshiva. So Rav Aaron Cutler threw him out of the yeshiva, and Rav Isser Zalman said, come live with me and I'll learn with you. And this goes on. Rav Isser Zalman becomes an advocate of the moderate Agudist position and he's one of the people involved with Ritzi Pesach Frank and Rav Kook in creating the Moatzah Datit. Actually, not with Rav Kook, Ritzi Pesach Frank, Rav Kook passed away, the religious committees in Israel, and he was very much aligned with that whole circle of the Yashav family, Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, the people who thought the State of Israel was a very positive thing but weren't Mizrahi. Not only did Yaakov Herzog study with Rav Isser Zalman, Yaakov Herzog got his smicha from Rav Isser Zalman. He never went to yeshiva. He might have gone to Hebron for a bit, but he got his smicha. He studied with his father and Rav Isser Zalman, and that's where he got smicha with. Rav Isser Zalman was very close with Rav Herzog. Both of them together found the Devada Yeshivas, which is supposed to take care of the yeshivas, raise money, and they put out together the Otzer HaPoskim. If you look in the early volumes, you see that. Then you can see Rav Isser Zalman's Haskam, his approbation to the Halacha Berura, this great Gemara which is put out in Israel by Merkas HaRav, in which has in the back, they summarize all the various views of the Rishonim. The first volume has a wonderful Haskam of Rav Isser Zalman. I remember when I was learning in the Boston Kollel, I brought it in once. We were running Erevin, and I just came out the volume of Erevin, and the guys in the yeshiva, it shows how little people know. And these are all Lakewood graduates now in Boston, and they should know about the history of Lakewood and the Rosh Yeshiva. They saw Rav Isser Zalman's Haskama there, and they couldn't believe it. You know, Haskama from Rav Kook, from Rav Isser Zalman, but they... that other person, thank you, David Eisen. So David Eisen gets the thank you for... if it wasn't for Yoel Finkelman interviewing him, these interesting recollections would never have been recorded. Now, in the most, just to give you a sense of the difference, in the most controversial passage of this book, of his book, Making of a Gadol, Rabbi Nassim Kamenetsky records that the altar of Slobodka, what happened was Rav Aaron Cutler wasn't in his youth this way. He wasn't as extreme as he would later be, and he would write letters to his fiancée, Rav Isser Zalman's daughter. And by the way, I used to serve Rav Isser Zalman's daughter at a hotel in Staten Island. When she was in her late 90s, I believe it was, she would come with her daughter, Revitzin Schwartzman, every Shabbos, because the person who owned the hotel was a Lakewood graduate. It was all the Frum people in the Haredi world, or the Feinstein family came and others. Interesting. This hotel, there was no mashgiach. I don't think today you can have a hotel without a mashgiach. The guy, they trusted the the Baha Bus, and Rav Aaron Cutler's daughter, Revitin Schwartzman, Dove Schwartzman from Beis HaTalmud. They were divorced, and she would come every week. She herself was a very interesting woman. You know, she was a delegate to the Democratic National Convention. She was a PhD candidate at Columbia in political science, Rav Aaron Cutler's daughter. The daughters, they usually gave them more secular education. But Rav Nosson Kamenetsky records that the Altar of Sobotka, when Rav Isher Zalman was concerned about these letters from Rav Aaron to his daughter, the altar predicted, quote, that in the future, don't worry about it, in the future we'll all suffer from his frumkeit. And I don't consider that necessarily a respectful thing about to say about Rav Aaron, and I understand why the people in Lakewood got very upset with that. They even burnt the book in Israel. And I don't know whether it's true even. In my review of the book, I pointed out that such a statement, you know, you sort of have to give a very significant attribution. Instead, he has an anonymous source. Be that as it may, you should know that it shows a bit about the reputation of Rav Aaron that he was seen to be later as very much on the right, much more than his father-in-law. And you should know that when in the Litvisha world, frumkeit is not a positive thing. Today, maybe people use it positive, but in the Litvisha world, you have halacha and then you have frumkeit. So in the Litvisha yeshiva, if someone speaks about it, it's frumkeit. That's a bad thing. That's, you know, some crazy chumra, or that's going, it's important to know, because you'll read things and people will comment on frumkeit and you won't get the sense, old Litvisha rabbanim, people I still knew, when they saw the changes happening in American Orthodoxy about 20 years ago, they'd comment how, and the Rav did himself also, that this is frumkeit, you know, so it wasn't viewed in a positive light. Now in the biography of Rav Shach, which biography? Well, there's one very interesting biography. Do I have it here? I don't think I have it here. It's called Shamaftechot Yado. This was published right when Rav Shach was at the height of his, or at the beginning of the height of his significance, 1989. Shamaftech Yado. You know, the key is in his hand. You know, he could bring governments up and destroy them as well. And it's a very interesting biography. I don't see anything in it even that the Haredim would find problematic. He has all sorts of informants, and he tells a very inspiring and interesting story. It tells us how in the early 1980s, when Rav Shach was the Gadol Hador for the Litvisha world, in Israel certainly, an unknown person in B'nai Brak died. Some nobody. Just passed away. And Rav Shach not only goes to the funeral, he walks to the cemetery, and here he's in his 90s already. And no one can understand what's going on here. The Gadol Hador going to the funeral of someone no one knows and walking to the cemetery, and they asked him. And by the way, I found this story subsequently from reading the biography. I found it in other sources as well. They asked him why this unknown person was worthy of receiving such kavod from Rav Shach. And Rav Shach said that he knew this person from his youth in Slutsk. And one very cold day, the man came into the Beis Medrash, and seeing Rav Shach sitting in a corridor without any coat, Rav Shach was extremely poor, he didn't even have a real coat, and Rav Shach was very cold, as you can imagine, didn't have heating like today, the man took off his coat, wrapped it around Rav Shach, and left it with him. And that, you get a sense, by the way, of the love that the typical Lithuanian balabas had for yeshiva bachrim. And Rav Shach always remembered that, and they reconnected when this person came to Israel and went to B'nai Brak, and therefore at his funeral, Rav Shach remembered that from 80 years before to go there. Now, he was in Slutsk and Kletsk for a number of years. In approximately 1925, Rav Shach was asked to come teach at a yeshiva established by the Karlin Stolliner Rebbe. There's a Hasidic group called Stolen. It's called Stolen today. But it begins as Karlin. They call it Karlin Stolen. It's one of the oldest, if not the oldest, Hasidic dynasties. And it's significant in that they also come from Lithuania. Very few Hasidists come from Lithuania, although there's a book by Harry Rabinovich precisely dealing with Hasidim from Lithuania. Much of the early anti-Hasidic polemics are directed against the Karliner Hasidim. And, you know, the polemics, how they, during their davening, they do somersaults and they get all enthusiastic. And to this day, I don't think they do somersaults anymore, but they do jump, you know, they jump up and get very excited. So much so that was it Rav Shach? I forget who it was. One of the Lithuanian Gedolim says that he would send his son to daven with the Karliner Hasidim to know what davening was. Was he friendly with the Belzer Rebbe? No, no, this is in Europe. He wasn't friendly with the Belzer Rebbe. Belzer Rebbe wasn't in Lithuania. Belzer Rebbe's in Hungary. Later on, we'll talk about his relationship with the Belzer Rebbe. Yes, we'll get to that. In Israel, he was. The Belzer Hasidim were the one Hasidic group that stood by him, whereas all the others abandoned him, or they said he abandoned them. We'll get to the Belzer Rebbe. Now, I actually had Yechidus early on in my youth. I wanted to meet a Hasidic Rebbe, and we were neighbors with a man named Sherman. His name is Herman Sherman in West Orange, New Jersey, and his brother was a man by the name of Nussan Sherman. And that, in those days, this was probably around 78, no one ever heard of Nussan Sherman. He was the principal of the Stolen Yeshiva. There's a Stolen Yeshiva in Borough Park, and the Rebbe at that time was about 20 years old. He was crowned Rebbe at his bris, but there was a regent, if I can use that term, until he was 18, I think. And I know people grew up with him in Borough Park, or maybe it was Crown Heights. He'd ride his bicycle and everything. He becomes Rebbe at 18. I went to see him a few years after that, because Rav Nussan Sherman was the Rosh Yeshiva of he was the principal of the secular studies, I believe, of this Stolen Yeshiva. And I remember I walked in, and he wanted to know why I wanted to meet him. My father took me there, and I didn't know. I just said, well, what do you guys say? You know, like, Satmar is against Israel, Lubavitch is in Kirov, and it was a very short meeting. Yes, they have a place in Borough Park, and I have actually been to the place in Borough Park, but the Rebbe now lives in Eretz Yisrael, and the Rebbe, I don't know if he's wealthy or his wealthy followers, but he has a very large, one of the largest private manuscript collections, Torah manuscripts in the world, and they have a journal called Beis Aron V'Yisrael, which comes out like six times a year, and every month they're publishing all sorts of jewels, and usually they say at the bottom, this comes from the manuscript collection of the Rebbe. Now, until well into the 19th century, Hasidic groups did not have yeshivas. In fact, they were even opposed to yeshivas. The Tzanzer Rebbe, Rav Chaim Halberstam, the great Tzanzer, the great Talmud Chacham, incidentally, he is the forefather of David Halberstam, if you can believe that, who was killed in a car crash earlier this year. Any Halberstam was related to the Tzanzer dynasty. He writes about how we don't have yeshivas, and for good reasons. Michael Silber has a whole article about what these reasons were. But the Hasidic world, they believe that you should continue studying as always have been studied, that is, in the local Beit Midrash. But towards the end of the 19th century, 20th century, they opened yeshivas. Actually, the beginning of the 20th century, Lubavitch opened Tamchei Tamimim and, earlier. Today, of course, they all have yeshivas. If you go to Israel, go to Har Nof or other places, and they're constantly putting up buildings, and they always say in the front of them, under the leadership, the siut of, they use the expression kuf kuf, kvod kedushas, that's the way they refer to the Rebbe, his holiness, the Rebbe Shlita. And it's important to say that because if the Rebbe passes away, a new Rebbe comes up, you don't have to change. It's like the Pharaoh. It's always under the leadership of the Rebbe Shlita, whoever the Rebbe is. Now, the Stoleners had this yeshiva, and they needed a Litvak to run it, because certainly if you're in Lithuania, you want to have a Litvisha Gadol, and in general, the Hasidim, especially then, were not known to be such great Lamdanim. And if you want to have the highest level, even in more recent generations, if you look at some of the great yeshivas, the Hasidic yeshivas, at least up until the last 30 or 40 years, they used to like to bring in Litvisha Rosh Yeshiva, because, you know, for Hasidus, you go to the Rebbe, and for Talmud, you go to the Rosh Yeshiva. I think there's another reason as well why they wanted to bring in outsiders, because in the Litvisha world, and this is going to be one of the great points of contention we'll see between Rosh Shach and the Hasidim, in the Litvisha world, the central figure is the Rosh Yeshiva. He's the most important figure, and he gets there because of his great Talmudic learning. In the Hasidic world, the most important figure is the Rebbe. Not the Rosh Yeshiva. The Rosh Yeshiva is like the posteg. He's a functionary. The Rebbe is the spiritual guide. Now, if you're going to have a great Rosh Yeshiva who's also a member of the Hasidic group, then Hasidim, it could create conflicts. Who do the Hasidim have their loyalty to? The Rosh Yeshiva? But when you have a Litvak, an outsider, it's obvious. He's just brought in as a technician, as a specialist to teach Talmud. But he's not a believer in the Rebbe. He's not a believer in the Hasidus. So he's not going to bring people away. There's not going to be a crisis of leadership. There's no competition, exactly. the Sovereigners, they came, the Rebbe came, Chabad. You know, by the way, I will say that Torah Vadaso had the Rabbi Rifkin, who was himself Chabad, but Chabad is always separate. Chabad always had great Lamdanim. And they would bring in non-Chabad as well, but they didn't need it to such an extent because there was a whole tradition. But many of the other Hasidic groups, they don't have a tradition of great Lamdanim like the Litvisha do. So I think it's important. They wanted to keep them two separate. They go to Rav Aaron Cutler, and they want someone to teach in the yeshiva, and Rav Shach takes the position. His wife and three children, at this time, he has three children. Unfortunately, a daughter would later die young while he was still in Europe. But they remained in Kletsk, or is it in Kletsk, yes. Now, in the biography of Rav Shach, HaMaftech Yado, it says that he lived in the dormitory with the students. I don't know if that's true, because I don't think, I'm not sure there was a dormitory, at least conventionally. All the sources I know claim that Yeshivas Chachmei Lublin, in Lublin, which was established in 1930, was the first yeshiva to have a dormitory. Now, I was there about 7 years ago. And at that time, it was a medical school. It turned to medical school, but I just saw a few weeks, I think it was even last week, pictures. Apparently, the Jews have gotten it back, and there was a whole celebration. They're rededicating it. I'm not exactly sure what they're doing with it. I don't think they're going to open a yeshiva, or maybe they have a kollel there or something, but this is a big building where you have apartments for the Rosh Yeshiva, and rooms for the students. Until then, a yeshiva was simply a building, a small building, and the students lived at people's houses. But so I doubt that it's true they lived in the dormitory. Of course, now we take this for granted. But I don't. Before World War II, I don't know of any other yeshiva other than Chachmei Lublin that had a dormitory. There's a famous story which is found not just in the biography, but it's legendary. It's found in the hagiographies as well. Famous story about Rav Shach during this period. There was a hilula of one of the Karlina Rebbe's. A hilula is something that in the Hasidic world, on the yort site of a Rebbe, it's considered a very special, a holy day, and you don't say tachnun on it, you have a get-together, you have a kiddush, you have schnapps, it's a celebration, you speak Torah of the Rebbe. It's not like the Litvisha. What did the Litvisha do? Like the Rav, what did he do on his yort sites? In addition to giving shir, he would just sit all day in YU, learning Mishnayos the whole day. For the Hasidim, it's a very joyous event. So on the hilula of one of the Rebbe's, the current Rebbe came to the area, and all the Bachrim of the yeshiva left the yeshiva that day to go, as you can imagine, go spend the day of the hilula with the Rebbe, the current Rebbe. It's a very inspiring for Hasidim. This is a great thing. Rav Shach comes to give shir, and there's no one there. The yeshiva is emptied out completely. He leaves. The Bachrim come back later that night. He's nowhere to be seen. He went back to Kletsk. When the Rebbe got in contact with him, why'd you leave the yeshiva? He said that he can't be in a yeshiva where going to Hilula and going to visit Rebbe's is more important than learning of Torah. So you see already the difference between the Lithuanian conception, Vitol Torah, and the Hasidish conception. Although I have to say, I do think this is an example of misnagdish prejudice. Why? Because certainly if a great Lithuanian Rosh Hashiva died, or if a Lithuanian Rosh Hashiva came to this town, all the Lithuanian Bachrim and the Litvish Yeshiva would go, with the Rebbeim's blessing. The Rebbeim would go as well. But among misnagdim, there's no appreciation for the significance of going to spend time and listen to the Rebbe tell maisios, because, I mean, that's, misnagdim might call them bava maisos, but it's very significant that Chassidic world, telling over maisos, telling over stories of previous Rebbes, is a form of worship, it's a form of spirituality. So that's the equivalent of the Litvisha going to hear Torah from a visiting Rosh Yeshiva. In any event, Rav Shach obviously saw it differently. And the Rebbe promised him, because they very much appreciated Rav Shach. They thought he was a great Rosh Yeshiva. Even at his early years, he was known to have a great head, to be a wonderful expositor of the Talmud, very clear. The Rebbe actually promised, and this is a huge concession, that something like this would never happen again. The only time, on holidays or things like that, the Hasidim could come, but they would never leave yeshiva time to go spend with the Rebbe. That raises an interesting point. I just said go on holidays. I think I should mention it. a lot of people speak about the Hasidim, you know, this revolution against the closed-minded Misnagdim, but at least in one area, I don't think there's any question that the Hasidim made it worse for the women. On holidays, the job of a Hasid is to leave his family and go spend it with the Rebbe and to bring his son. They go to Uman today, you know, 10,000 people. This is not the Litvisha approach. In fact, Ravadi Yosef spoke out against this last year, going to Uman. I mean, can you imagine Rosh Hashanah or Sukkot or something? You leave your family and you go to spend it with the Rebbe. This makes it very difficult for the women. So I think it's fair to say, although I've never seen this pointed out in any books, that women actually, their position was made worse under Hasidim. In fact, I don't even think you can call women Hasidim. What does it mean to be a Hasid? A Hasid means you spend time with the Rebbe. First of all, it means you weren't Hasidus, and the women never weren't Hasidus. It means you spend time with the Rebbe at the Tish on Friday night, Shalosh Shudas. Women had no connection whatsoever to the Rebbe. They just continued living as they used to. That is the same today as well. I think the one exception is Lubavitch. Lubavitch, first of all, the Rebbe would speak to the women. There would be special gatherings where he spoke to women. In fact, I can show you a kuntras against Chabad in which they attacked the Rebbe for sitting with all these women. And also, the Rebbe created this idea that every member of Chabad, man, woman, you all have a mission. And of course, you know, when the shulchim go out, they go out as a couple, and the Rebbe's in there, the woman is just as important as the man. A book was written a couple of years ago about the role of the Hasidish of women, about the Lubavitch women. And the men could not do what they do if it wasn't for the women. So they're there as a team. So certainly in Chabad, the women are very much Hasidim. But if you take a traditional Hasidic woman, a Kleisenberger woman, I mean, in what sense can you say she's a Hasid? I mean, so I don't know. Yes, now this is a new thing where they leave the women, they go back to their yeshivas, Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. But that, it was the Ponevezh Rosh Yeshiva, Rav Kahaneman, who invented the idea of the Arche Kala, where they come for like a week to get together. But this idea of going back for Rosh Hashanah, I know there's some people do it, they say it gets the batteries going again, but this was never done in Europe. And, I mean, it's very problematic, truthfully. Your job is supposed to be with your family. Wasn't this what happened during Aliyah Lerego? Why didn't the women come up Aliyah Lerego? Didn't they have the Karban Pesach? All the women stayed home. I'm assuming women went there as well. But if they didn't, I guess the Litvish answer would be that was halacha. I don't know. In any event, I find it hard to believe that the men would leave all their women behind. I don't know. It's not for me to judge, but I do think this was one of the issues, that the women were left by themselves, and this is not the way it was done in the Litvish world. Yeah, I know there's no chiyuv, but I don't know. And besides, again, it's so long ago. It's a different era completely. No, I know they carbon pace up, but maybe they didn't go up for the other times. It's hard to imagine what the woman is supposed to run the Shabbos meals herself, the Pesach, the Sukkot meals. Pesach, they certainly were there. It's hard to imagine. In general, it's hard to imagine what went on during Aliyah Lerego. So the Carliner was able to convince Rav Shach to return. And by the way, according to the stories, he wasn't going to go. It was Rav Aaron Cutler prevailed upon him to give them one more chance. And he was now getting a reputation as a great scholar. He was also becoming close to the Gedolim, establishing personal relationships with Rav Chaim Moser Grzinski. In fact, his own daughter's funeral, Rav Chaim Moser watched his little children. They had a very close relationship. He'd go to Vilna and spend time with Rav Chaim Moser Grzinski. This becomes very important because, as we'll see, Rav Shach sees himself as following the path of the Gedolim, not innovating at all. Now, in 1938, Kletsk, there was a trade, right? Lithuania trade, made a trade of territory. Kletsk was given to the Soviet Union, and in exchange, Vilna was returned to Lithuania. And the yeshiva moved to Vilna. Okay. Now, people who saw what was happening in Europe were looking for ways out. When I say people, most people didn't think anything was going on, and they didn't, they thought this too will pass. But there were people very insightful people who said, now's the time to get out. War clouds were on the horizons, and they didn't think it was going to be safe. And especially once World War II began. Once World War II began, yes, they're in Lithuania, so war hadn't yet happened, but war was going on in Poland, so people started looking for ways out. It should be said that most did not go. In fact, in reading the book on the Mir Yeshiva that just came out, I'm shocked that they included this. They included a passage from Rav Aryeh Leib Malin, someone else recording Rav Aryeh Leib Malin said, that discussed how the Gedolim were all wrong. And that the only Gedolim who were right were the ones, you know, with the Mir Yeshiva. I mean, because this really puts the notion of Das Torah to a horrible test. But it talks about how the Gedolim were wrong, because many Gedolim said, don't go. And they thought it was crazy. From Jews, they're going to go to Japan? I mean, who ever heard of such a thing? But many were looking for ways out. Now, Rav Herzog had arranged for certificates of entry to Palestine for a number of yeshiva students and rabbis. Using his offices, because the white paper was in effect, there was no immigration, but he was able to argue that we need, you know, these were scholars of the law, we need religious leaders. The British government gave him a certain amount. The question was, how do you get from Vilna to the land of Israel? There already was war going on in Poland, so you couldn't go west. They needed to get to a port, because you had to sail to get to Israel, or so was thought. And the Baltic Sea wouldn't help you, because where are you going to go from the Baltic Sea? It's the wrong side. You can't take a ship there from Palestine. What they wanted to do was to somehow get to Turkey, and from Turkey, or get to Odessa, and take a ship there to the land of Israel. Then what eventually happens is they get to Odessa, as I'll speak, and from there, they take a ship to Turkey, and from Turkey, they actually take a train through Syria and Lebanon until they reach Rosh HaNikra. I don't know if there's a train there anymore, or even train tracks, but they reach there traveling through Turkey. But how did they get to Turkey? I just said they took a ship from Odessa. Is everyone else's sound gone? Bill, maybe your thing probably was pulled out. Try clicking it back in again. How do you get from Vilna to Odessa? Odessa is in the Soviet Union. Soviet Union didn't allow people to enter. You couldn't just go there. So how do you get from there? Enter Rav Herzog again. Rav Herzog was in communication with the Rosh Yeshiva and others. He flies to London, where he meets with the Russian ambassador. And he's able, we don't know how, I mean, the stories, if you open the book on the Mir Yeshiva, of course, this is regarded as a great miracle. He's able to prevail upon the Russian ambassador, appeal to his sense of this sense of kindness, that these are religious students. He's able to prevail upon the Russian ambassador to arrange that the yeshiva students are to travel through the Soviet Union. Also, they came up with money. They were able to bring hard currency, which was a help. And many of them actually end up going all the way through the Soviet Union to the other side of the Soviet Union, where they go on to Japan. But a group of them, which Herzog again was responsible for, take the train to Odessa. Not just Rav Shach, the Brisker Rav, Rav Yitzchak Zev Soloveitchik is one of them. Unfortunately, his wife and daughters were supposed to shortly follow. His wife, though, did not want to leave her elderly mother. She remains in Vilna, and she is killed with his daughters. The Brisker Rav had come with his sons, and he had gone, Rav Eliezer Yehuda Finkel, the nearer Rosh Yeshiva. He did not go with the yeshiva to Shanghai. Rav Zalman Sarutskin, Rav David Pabarsky, another one of the becomes a Rosh Yeshiva Chevron, and Rav Kreisworth, Senior Rav Chaim Kreisworth, who later comes to America, is in Skokie, and then in Antwerp, becomes the Rav of Antwerp. They were all on this train that goes to Odessa, and then they were able to take a boat to Turkey. Now, the way rescue worked was that, as I said, the rabbi, Rav Herzog, and not just him, all the other rabbanim, they focused on saving the rabbis and yeshiva students. The Zionist leaders focused on, because they also had influence and they had a certain amount of certificates, they focused on getting certificates to save Zionists. One of the exceptions was, I spoke about this with the Satmar Rebbe, was that Kastner, a leading Zionist, he used his certificate to save the leading anti-Zionist, the Satmar Rebbe. And supposedly, because his mother came to him in a dream, told him to do that, but that's how it worked. Now, I'm not saying this was right. I'm not saying this was wrong, either. That's the way it was done. And for as far as Herzog was concerned, maybe that's all he could do was get certificates for rabbis. But even if Herzog was just given certificates and he could use them however he wanted to, there's no question he would have used them for yeshiva students, for rabbis, just like the Zionist leaders use it for their people. That's the way of the world, and I don't know if there's anything wrong with that. I think if you have the ability to save people, no one says that you have to just put it in a lottery. You can save family. You can save close friends. You're not killing anyone. You're just saving some people. And that's how they worked. And those who are interested, take a look at the Sekharim blog. You can get some details on this with regard to the hoppers that I wrote about in a recent one. How do you decide who is more valuable when you have to save people? Returning to the story, Rav Shach arrives in the land of Israel. He goes to Jerusalem, where he lives with Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer, his wife's uncle. A short while after being there, Rav Moshe Avigdor Amiel, the chief rabbi of Tel Aviv, a figure who we should definitely devote at least one class to. He is the great-grandfather, if I'm not mistaken, of the famous Lindenbaum family in New York, formerly Rav of Antwerp, becomes chief rabbi, beats out Rav Soloveitchik and Rav Herzog for the chief rabbinate of Tel Aviv in 1932. I believe it is. He established a new yeshiva called HaYeshiva HaChadash in Tel Aviv. And as I said, he was a leading Mizrahi figure. He comes to Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer. He's trying to find Rashi Yeshiva. When I say Rashi Yeshiva, he's trying to find this is more of like a high school. They didn't have secular subjects, but they're more high school age people. And he wants to find Ramim in his yeshiva. It wasn't a Haredi yeshiva. It was a Mizrahi yeshiva, but you really didn't have any Haredi yeshivas in those days. I could show you a picture of Yeshivas Kol Torah, which was established around this time by German Orthodox emigres, and there's a picture of Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach and his class sit outside learning, and not only is everyone in white, they're wearing short pants. I mean, it was a very different culture in those days. What made the yeshiva HaYishuv HaChadash significant, though, was that the shiurim were given in Hebrew. That was interesting already. And Rav Shach took the position, and he was a Ram there. Why not? He was only there a short while, though, and there's different versions as to why he left. In one of the hagiographies I have on him, it says it speaks of the Brisker Rav. In this biography I referred to you before, it speaks of the Chazon Ish. I think the Chazon Ish is more likely. The story goes that the Rav Shach was meeting one day with the Chazon Ish, because, as I said, he became very close to the Chazon Ish and the Brisker Rav, and the Chazon Ish asked him, why are you teaching at Rabbi Amiel's yeshiva? It's not a place for you. And he resigns. He doesn't even have another position. It says he doesn't even tell his wife, because she would have gone crazy. What are we going to do for make a living? He just resigns because the Chazon Ish told him to. And it wasn't long, though, that they got him a position at the Navardic yeshiva. The Navardic yeshiva is one of the great Musar yeshivas from Israel, from Europe. We spoke about the Navardic yeshiva in one of the previous classes, how Benjamin Netanyahu's father-in-law was a student in the Navardic yeshiva. He wrote a book last year about his experiences in the Navardic yeshiva. He's apparently come back to religion in his old age. It was a very extreme yeshiva, although in fact that they used to say that in the Sabbatki yeshiva they build you up, in the Navardic yeshiva they shoot you down. They try to destroy your individuality, you know, show you are nothing. I'll tell the joke, which I told already, but maybe some of you didn't hear it. Well, first of all, they would walk into, let's say, a pharmacy, and they'd ask for nails. That's the classic story. So they'd be humiliated. They would confess their sins publicly to be humiliated, to get rid of all their ego. This is a joke, they'd walk around in dirty shirts. So when someone asked them, maybe it's not a joke, the Rambam says if a Talmid Chacham has a dirty shirt, he's chai of misa, he's deserving of death because he makes a chil Hashem, and they replied that that's only if the shirt's white and there's one dirty spot, but our entire shirt is dirty. But the joke is, and this, I think says something, gives you a sense of them, is that, in the Navardic yeshiva, they would sit you know, people would sit for an hour and they'd say to themselves, you know, I'm a nobody, I'm a nobody. You know, try to get rid of the individuality, the ego, whereas in the Sabbath Yeshiva, the idea was to build up your ego, to show you that you're a creature of God and that you can accomplish great things. In the Sabbath Yeshiva, they dressed very finely with the fanciest styles, not like today. Whatever was being worn by, you know, the wealthy people, they wanted to dress like that, so they felt pride in their appearance. It was the exact opposite in the Vardic. So the story is that these guys walk into yeshiva one day and they see some stranger going back and forth. I'm a nobody. I'm a nothing. I can't accomplish anything. So one guy says to the other guy, hey, look who thinks he's a nobody. But that sort of extremism really fell by the wayside, but it was a different type of yeshiva than the other Mussi yeshivas. The Stipler, the brother-in-law of the Chazon Ish, who becomes the closest of friends to Rav Shach and the leaders of the Haredi world. He was a graduate of the Navardic Yeshiva, so this notion that you can't become a great Talmudic scholar going to Navardic is certainly not correct. It's just that they had a much more austere approach to each their own. The Aruch HaShulchan was not connected to the Yeshiva. The Aruch HaShulchan was Rav in Navardic. First the Aruch HaShulchan was Rav in Novozibkov, which was the city of my step-grandfather I spoke about last class, which then becomes Rav Zevin's town. It's a Chabad town. Then he goes to Navardic. So he was not officially connected, but during the great dispute that broke out about Musar, just like during the dispute about Hasidus, they focused on Karliner and Breslov, they focused on Navardic, the opponents of Musar. That includes Tzvi Rabinowitz, the son of Rav Yitzchak Chanan, and many other Gedolim. They thought that the Musar movement was becoming another cult, a sect. And they attacked, and one of the, if you want to talk about horror stories, look at what they do in Navardic. And the Aruch HaShulchan, together with a number of other people, publishes an open letter. It appeared in all the Hebrew newspapers. You can find it in the book by Dov Katz, Pumus HaMusar, which describes the whole feud. This book has never been reprinted. His Tnuat HaMusar has been reprinted a few times. I don't know if they'll ever reprint Pumus HaMusar, because today, the yeshiva world doesn't, I don't think they want us to have to read about this machokes, what the Rosh Yeshiva was saying about the Musar yeshivas. Although the Sri Deyesh has a letter at the beginning of Katz's book in which he says it's vital to tell the whole story, pro and con, supporters and opponents of Musar. And Rav Yecheskel Sarna also said the same thing. The Aruch HaShulchan took out a letter saying, I know these yeshiva bachrim. This is my city, and that they're completely kadoshim, they're pure, they're holy. So he became a great defender of the yeshiva, although he had no connection. It's not like the Rav of Volozhin, who was also the Netziv, who was also the Rosh Yeshiva of the Volozhin yeshiva. He had no official connection to it. No, the reprint you're thinking of, yes, in this volume 4 of Sri Deyesh, she has a lot of articles on Musar, and he even speaks there about the Musar feud. But he has a letter to Dov Katz, which was printed at the beginning of Pomos HaMusar, in which he explains to him, and I reprinted this also, if I'm not mistaken, in volume 2 of Kitzrei of Yechayak of Weinberg, in which he tells him that it's important to know the whole story, that you cannot be a real historian, he tells Dov Katz, and cover up things. And people need to know what it was. Why did Gedolei Yisrael, very important Gedolei, think that the Musar movement was leading people astray? Rav Chaim Soloveitchik is not exactly what the Gemara calls a katli kane ba'agme. He's not some nobody. And he was opposed to Musar. And you need to understand why he thought Musar was a bad idea. I was able to convince this guy a number of years ago to print a limited edition to give out to people of the Sefer. So I have a copy of it. So he taught at the Navardic Yeshiva, and his wife at this time, while it was working, how can you get it? Well, best I can do is maybe make a PDF of it for you. It's now books are not so valuable. You can make it a PDF. I can make it for you. Rav Dov Katz, incidentally, just to give some background, who comes from Sobotka and wrote these wonderful books, his father-in-law was Zev Gold, Rabbi Zev Gold, one of the leaders of Mizrahi. He's a signer of the Declaration of Israel's Declaration of Independence. Machon Gold is named after him. I have a connection because he was a rabbi in Scranton, Pennsylvania for a number of years, and then he leaves Scranton, goes to New York, where he's one of the founders of the Torah Vadas Yeshiva. Torah Vadas was founded, Vadas, and about Torah and secular studies, it was founded by Mizrahi. People today don't realize that. And Dov Katz's son-in-law is today the Rav of Ma'ale Adunim. I forgot his name. Very, very hush of the family. His wife, Rav Shach's wife was, she's not even a nurse. She went to medical school. Here's a picture of her. You see her there. Like the typical Lithuanian Revitz in no shade, but I'm not sure if she didn't wear it. This is a passport picture. Her son told me that they took off, that she had to take it off for that. I don't think she was a typical Lithuanian Revitz. In any event, she was a very, from reading the book, you see she's a very strong personality, she knew she came from Yichus, and a very, very supportive of her husband, but also a woman in her own mind, a career woman, one who was, could have been a doctor, that would have been something that women did in those days. He was only in Novartek for a short while, and then he began teaching in Petah Tikva. Rav Reuven Katz opened a yeshiva. Rav Reuven Katz, known as the Degel Reuven, a great, great Talmud Chacham, was Rav in Europe, then comes to America, was Rav in Bayonne, New Jersey for a few years, left a few sons in America, including one is Abraham Katz, who was at Dropsy College, and Leon Katz was one of the rabbis in Passaic for a number of years, and also children in Israel. He becomes the Rav of Petah Tikva. He has his son Rav Michal Katz. That's right, Rav Michal Katz, who passed away a couple of years ago, was another one of his sons, taught at YU, also published, it was his doctorate dissertation, if I'm not mistaken, one of the Rishonim on Chumash, I forget which one now. So a very important family, and he opened up a yeshiva there, and Rav Reuven Katz was not a Guda, but he wasn't Mizrahi either. He was somewhere in the middle, a Talmud of Rav Chaim Ozer, and he goes to teach there for a few years, and then he goes to Rehovot. Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer's son had opened a yeshiva, which was supposed to be the reincarnation of the Kletzk yeshiva, and this was called Yeshivat HaDarom, Yeshiva of the South. And if I'm not mistaken, the RCA had a long connection with it. They used to support this yeshiva for a while. And Rav Shach teaches there, and also teaching at this time when people like Rabbi Mordechai Breuer, in fact, Mordechai Breuer described how he came to his new ideas about how to study Tanakh, and that there's really source criticism, but it's all, that Wellhausen is absolutely correct, although it's not different documents of different people, it's different documents coming down from God. And he describes in one of his book, the articles, how Rav Shach heard there was something strange going on, and he called him up, and after Mordechai Breuer explained to him, he didn't see what the problem was. Rav Amital also taught at Yeshiva HaDarom. They were all colleagues together at this yeshiva. Rav Amital is actually married to the granddaughter of Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer, so their family as well. He only stayed there a few years, and his last stop was the Ponovez Yeshiva, which he joins in 1951. This yeshiva was run by Rav Yosef Shlomo Kahaneman. Yosef Shalom Kahaneman, and was in B'nai Brak. It originally, as I said, began as a small yeshiva around World War I. It wasn't one of the major yeshivas. It's reincarnated in Israel. It becomes a great yeshiva. Rav Kahaneman was a great fundraiser. He was also a great personality. He was not an extremist by any means. He had very good relationships with many religious Zionist figures. To this day, the flag of Israel is flown every Yom HaTzmaut. So you can go to B'nai Brak and you can see it. They put it up, they let it fly for about an hour or two, then they take it down. Why do they do that? When Rav Shach, obviously, Rav Shach, as we'll see, opposed this, anything having to do with the flag. And when he became Rosh Hashiva, they said, let's stop this practice. And they said, whatever the Rosh Hashiva began, we continue. And every year, the Kanaim and B'nai Brak attacked the Ponovez Yeshiva. But to this day, they still fly the flag out there. It was a very different type of figure than the Chazon Ish or others. If any of you went to the Yeshiva University, 65, no, not 65, it's one flag. If any of you went to the YU Museum exhibit on the study of Talmud, you saw video from the Ponovez Yeshiva. In fact, you don't need to go to the exhibit. It's now all online. If you go to printingthetalmud.org, you can see the video footage which they showed there. And there was this person who took video footage of the Ponovez Yeshiva from the 30s, and there you see Rav Kahaneman with the Bacharim from the 1930s when he's a young man. And it's always great to see those pictures of Lithuanian yeshivas. You see the dress and how different it is, but quite interesting pictures. Well, just two more minutes. Until the late 1970s, though, the Haredim were really a meaningless component in Israeli politics. The Aguda had a few seats, that's it. And although they had been in the first government of Itamar Levin, since then they refused to be in any government, so they were always in the opposition, really had no significance. They sat with Begin in the opposition. There was a draft exemption for yeshiva students. Ben-Gurion agreed with this because in 1948 there was 600 students. The numbers were never large. It didn't concern most people. And as I said, the typical non-Haredi knew nothing about the Haredi world and probably never even heard the name of the Panavez Yeshiva. But in the late 1970s, the Haredi population really begins growing. Everything begins to change. Menachem Begin is elected. And there's a whole new landscape. You know, what's regarded as a friendly government, once again rejoining the coalition, and Rav Shach really emerges on the scene. And next class, that's where we're going to pick up, talk about his hashkafa, how he molded the Haredi world, and also his great machlokas, not just with Chabad, he had other machlokas, not just with Haredi leaders, with non-Haredi leaders, and it's a legacy which has great achievements, but also questionable achievements, as we'll see, because at least from the other side, many people believe that he created a Litvisha world today, which is not friendly for many non-Litvisha, and that was very different than the Litvisha world from the 40s and 50s. But we'll have to analyze it. I think after I put it in context, I think you'll see that Rav Shach gets a bad rap, I think, from many portrayals, that really... He's really following a tradition. He's not the one who's changed anything. The other people have changed it. But we'll get to that next class. No, he was not known as a Kanai before Panavez. First of all, he wasn't known at all. He was not known as a Kanai before Panavez because he wasn't a significant figure. Especially when he's living in Bnei Brak, he absorbs not just the Chazon Ish, he becomes very close to the Stipler, who was a Kanai. And I'll argue even more Kanai than the Chazon Ish to a certain extent, because the Chazon Ish refused to be involved officially in politics. Although he had views which maybe were Kanai-ish, he didn't make them public in the same way. In any event, we'll see that there is a direct link from Rav Shach through the Stipler and the Chazon Ish and the Brisker Rav. So it's not his Kanai-ish. He's simply following a tradition. There's two Litvisha traditions. There's a Cheskel Sarna, Moshe Mordechai Epstein, Rav Zalman Meltzer, a more moderate Litvisha tradition, and then there's the Chazon Ish, Rav Aaron Cutler, a more extreme Litvisha tradition, and Rav Shach is following the more extreme Litvisha tradition, and we'll see it created big machlokas in the Litvisha world as well. Okay, any other questions or comments? We'll see next class. That's what really next class. The more moderate tradition today, the Litvisha world doesn't really have a more moderate, well, I shouldn't say it. Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, Rav Zalman Nechemia Goldberg, that was always the more moderate tradition. Jerusalem was always more moderate than Bnei Brak. The Chevron Yeshiva in Givat Mordechai was always regarded as a center for more moderation. So there always was a difference. Just to give you an example, every year, Rabbi Cheskel Sarna, the Rosh Hashiva of Chevron Yeshiva, would go to Heichal Shlomo to participate in events at Heichal Shlomo. In Bnei Brak, there was a Cherem in Heichal Shlomo. It was forbidden to step foot in it. So it was a more moderate tradition. So you ask about Rav Shach, as we'll see next class. The difference is, it's one thing to be a Kanai when you have no power. Rav Shach, though, was adopting the same positions, and now they had power to make and break governments. They had tens and tens of thousands of people, so that they could fill stadiums. And he was broadcast live by Israeli television. So when you're a Kanai, I don't even want to use the word Kanai, when you have extremist positions from the standpoint of the moderate, or certainly from religious Zionists, obviously it's going to be more significant than when you don't have. And we'll see Rav Shach doesn't have to, it's not only people on the left he's responding to. He also has to deal with his own Kanaim, because he provides the imprimatur of joining the government. Until then, they were in the opposition, the Haredi parties. Not only that, the Kanaim were following a tradition from the Brisker Rav himself, which said that you're not supposed to vote. And Rav Shach's attitude was, it's an obligation to vote. So he had to deal with Kanaim on his right. So it's all relative. People, you might think that Rav Shach comes out as a Kanai, but from his perspective, he has people on his right who think that he's a big compromiser. Look, Rav Aryeh Leib Steinman, who follows in his tradition, he gave approval for this Nachal Haredi. When he came to Israel, the Kanaim here, when he came to America, the Kanaim threw stones at him and protested him. So it all depends on your vantage point, where you are. And this is what we'll deal with next class. Rav Aryeh Levin is in Rav Cook's school. So he's not in that school even. He's in a different school. When we speak about the Nazir and Rav Tzvi Yehuda, Rav Aryeh Levin is Rav Tzvi Yehuda's school. So it's a completely different tradition. Rav Shach never studied secular material. Unlike the Chazon Ish, who we know studied it in Yiddish, Rav Shach, as far as we know, never studied it. And this will also be interesting when I speak about his son, because his son breaks with his father and goes to YU. And this creates a very interesting dynamic. And I'll just say it. You can remember this the next week, but I'll elaborate more when we meet next class. For all his Kanaisha attitudes, we can't forget the fact that Rav Shach's own family didn't follow him, and he had a loving relationship and a supportive relationship for his son and his grandchildren that went the very route, the religious Zionist route, that he opposed. So we're going to have to distinguish again between rhetoric and reality. Families are, and friends, he had friendships with Mizrahi figures, long friendships. I mean, these are things we'll have to get to next class, because there's a caricature of Shach as an ideologue, one who can't see the other side. And yes, as a public person, that was perhaps the impression you got, but as a private person, he had close relationships with all sorts of people. Like I said, his own family, just to anticipate, his granddaughter went to the army. From Rav Shach's perspective, it's the Harig Del Yavar. A girl cannot go to the army. And yet the concern he showed for his granddaughter, always calling up his son, how is she, where is she, or things like that. I mean, so we'll have, it's a complicated situation, as I think all Gedolim are complicated. It's only the ideologues who are not. Yes, of course he had a loving relationship with his son. There was a bit of tension. I'll tell you this quick story, but I'll save the rest for next class. When Rav Shach's son, I'll tell you the whole story about his son. When Rav Shach's son's mother died, his son was in America teaching at Flatbush, if I'm not mistaken, and Rav Shach refused to delay the funeral to allow his son to come back. And his son, for years, had this negative feeling towards his father. Couldn't the father, what's so special? That he had to delay, he couldn't delay the funeral until Rav Lorenz from the Aguda, he told his son, it was Bittul Torah. His father couldn't delay. Yeah, his grandson is not religious. I'll get to that. Next class we'll talk about it. His grandson became a paratrooper, became non-religious. The scene of his grandson coming into the Beis Medrash in his army uniform, none of the new Bachrim know who this guy is. He goes up to his father, gets up, his grandfather gives him a big hug. The typical yeshiva bachrim, who are, of course, all kanaim, hate the army and everything. Here, this guy comes into the yeshiva in green. They're all in black. They don't know who this guy is. He walks right up to the shtender, and there's stories how he'd wait by the shtender. He'd just stand there, and they don't know who's this crazy guy. And then his grandfather comes in and runs up to him and gives a big hug. I mean, you had the students there. They didn't know who this was. And so it's a complicated relationship. But you see how the leading ideologue could still be, with his whole neshama, his whole nefesh, still be connected to the world that, at least in theory, he thought was an invalid world. So we'll get to that next class. And I mentioned one more thing, because we've had examples of children of Gedolim and grandchildren who've written about how they couldn't have a relationship with their father, Rav Abramsky, for example. Rav Yechezkel Abramsky had a son who basically was estranged from him, and we had examples of this. But we have other examples, like Rav Klatskin, Eliyahu Klatskin's son was non-religious. You have Rav Shach's grandson, who, that's not their experience at all, although obviously their grandparents or parents had strong feelings, they never stopped loving them, they never stopped having close relationships to them. It's different personalities. Some parents, and not just Gedolim, non-Gedolim, some parents are not able to accept the fact that children choose a different way of life, especially a non-Torah way of life, and yet we have so many Gedolim who, as children, chose different ways of lives, and they still remained. After all, they're flesh and blood. Okay. So we'll pick up, unless any other questions or comments. I don't want to talk about what I'm going to talk about next class, but just questions on what we spoke about today, or comments.
Okay, thank you. I'll let you go at 10:09, but thank you very much for a fascinating class.
Okay, so we will pick up next class. Until then, see, have a good week. Bye-bye, everyone.